welcome to Parents Perspective. Follow me, 12-year-old Derek called to the group of parents and students as they clattered down the middle school hallway. Outside, you can see the solar panels that boosted our heating system. And if you look in here, he opened the door to a classroom as the group crowded around. You'll see how extra bright it is. Your lighting bill must be a biggie, one father noted. Not at all, Derek replied. We have special reflective solar panels that increase the natural light in here, in addition to all these great skylights. He smiled. It keeps everyone wide awake. Is it true you grow stuff on the roof here? One of the visiting students piped up. You bet, Derek grinned. We use recycled rainwater and harvest vegetables and herbs. Next stop, the roof garden. From a parent's perspective, what can we do to help our kids become more eco-savvy? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has had experience with these kinds of issues over a number of years. Dave Honchok recently retired as supervisor of outdoor education for Montgomery County, Maryland schools. He serves as a trustee for the Maryland Association for Environmental and Outdoor Education, a nonprofit educational association that provides certification for green schools in the state. Dave is the father of 8-year-old twin boys and a 10-year-old daughter. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dave.
Thank you.
In this era of high technology, why is it so important for kids to connect with their natural world?
I think children today have less of a natural opportunity to experience the outdoors. I think about my own children. I think about what they go through. Their day is more structured. There's more expectation that they're going to be involved in after-school sports, things that you would normally say, great, they're outdoors, but they're outdoors in a very controlled situation. And I think that kids of all ages need more experiences outdoors that are less designed by an adult for them, and they have more opportunity to explore, more opportunity to discover things on their own.
Of course, that's a problem in our society where we're afraid for their safety, isn't it?
The stranger danger phenomena is tough to deal with. I deal with my own kids. Are they being too overly friendly? My experience, particularly out of doors, people are more gregarious, more outgoing, more friendly. They speak to kids. They like to see kids. Hey, look at this thing. So it's tough to not overreact to that. And I think media has played a large part in helping us overreact in some cases.
Where my children grew up, there was a creek not too far behind our house. There was a path that led down into the woods, through the neighborhood, down to the creek. All the kids went to the creek with their buckets, their shovels, their butterfly nets to catch things and to just hang out. And the parents didn't go with them. It was wonderful. Of course, my kids are grown-ups now. And I think if my kids were growing up now, we would feel that at least one of the parents should be with them if we could get them to go outside to do that.
That is true. We have that current sense, but I still think that you can provide opportunities by not hovering over the kids, by giving them a chance to explore, by not going with the preset notion of, here's what we're going to do today. Streams are wonderful places for kids. They like to get wet, so you have to deal with kids getting a little muddy, a little dirty coming back. But they also just find things on their own, and they pose questions that then you can delve into a little deeper.
Even, I would guess, with little ones, toddlers, just to take a walk with them and let them sort of sort through all the rocks they see on the sidewalks or the little things growing up through the cracks.
It's amazing, and I've not worked a lot with preschool and small kids other than my own, but it's amazing that you can plan. We're going to go from point A to point B, and it takes you 3 to 4 times as long as you thought because there's something that catches their eye. They're kind of like a puppy. Now you see this little movement, and they're over there. They want to know about it. That needs to be encouraged in kids.
Like the seashore, where every shell is a miracle to them. And really, when you think about it, it is.
I have a refrigerator in the basement, and I opened it one time. My kids were 4 or 5, and the shelves were full of rock collection. Mm-hmm. Now, why would you collect rocks, put them in the basement refrigerator? I don't know. They treasured it. That was valuable to them.
What are some kid-friendly ways that youngsters can learn about our ecosystem?
Well, I think to take advantage of open space that you have, whether it's a state park, whether it's a local park, and just allow kids to walk without any particular goal. Let them explore a little bit. If there's the opportunity to get off the trail, let them get off the trail. That's the simplest way to get kids involved. But there are tons of programs out there that give kids the chance to investigate in a nature center setting. They can participate in agency type things, like in Maryland, the Department of Natural Resources has certain programs that they offer in the summer and other programs. All the nature centers have programs for kids that are very hands-on and less concerned than a school system may be with making sure they have a strong academic tie-in or a focus. It gives kids that chance to explore a bit.
Can you stack the deck a little bit when you go out with your youngster, however old? I mean, not a teenager, obviously, but somebody who would still be perfectly happy going outside with you and going on a walk or something, and take something. Take a little butterfly net, or take one of these magnifying glasses that can stand up on its own, or take a bucket, or take something, and that gives you a little focus.
A tiny net for catching those grasshoppers that happen to be there, or butterflies that happen to be there, taking the little insect viewing things that you can put it in and it has a magnifier at the end so they can look at it. And then you can get into trying to present a bit of a lesson about what are some of the adaptations of this particular insect, or why is it behaving like it is here? And you can talk about the release, and when they get the powder from the butterfly wing, you can talk about how that's an adaptation for them for flight and how that's important to them. You can look at all of those things that you may want to start increasing in a sense in kids. But I think the important thing is, before someone can value knowledge about something, they have to learn to love that. And I think by taking kids out and giving them that experience, letting them feel good about being in the woods. And for some kids, it's a frightening area because they don't go there.
It's a shame when you think about it. The seasons, as they change, should be a wonderful experience for kids, tromping in the crunchy leaves in the fall, or the snow when it comes down, sticking out their tongue to catch the snowflakes, or any of that kind of stuff.
All of those sensory things, which you can't measure. You can't put some value in terms of a number assigned to it, but it certainly, I think, is important developmentally to kids to have that type of an experience.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on eco-savvy kids.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dave Honchok about helping our kids learn to be eco-savvy.
It's very easy to raise couch potatoes in today's world. The kids have so many things to do inside when they're not in school, or when they're not at their basketball practice or their soccer game or whatever it is. And so besides telling them, hey, don't forget to turn off the lights, how can we get the point across to them that we have a beautiful, wonderful world and they have a part in it?
I think the biggest part of that is modeling behavior that you want. I think as a parent, you need to model something other than going outside as a chore to mow the grass or shovel snow or do whatever it is. Model going out and taking a walk and enjoying that and looking at leaves as they fall and saying, wow, look at the color on this one, or look at the color on that one. Let kids collect things, whether they come back and they clutter it up and then you get rid of it when they're not looking.
Just watch out for those acorns that breed.
Right. I think by doing those types of activities and just having them have positive experiences builds that sort of love of being out of doors. Mm-hmm. I also think that you can start to build those messages with kids with lights, with carpooling, with, hey, I'm going to park the car over here in the parking lot and we'll walk to the two stores rather than drive the 100 yards to the other store. And explain very simply why you're doing that, because you're trying to conserve energy. You don't want to contribute more than you need to. And start kids thinking that way.
You're also trying to do something for them because you're bodybuilding by taking a walk.
What should schools be doing?
Well, this is an area that I feel schools should be doing lots of things. I think the biggest is when you look at school buildings, they're built from an adult perspective. They're built for ease of maintenance, ease of management, pretty much cleared areas. They come in, and if there are trees or anything, they clear them. There are security concerns. You don't want shrubs and things next to the building because that's a possibility for a person to hide and those types of things. But I think there's a movement to make more exciting and kid-oriented buildings with areas for kids to have natural play areas. Some of the European countries are way ahead of us in terms of their playgrounds have natural features and areas to swing across and logs that are slanted so they can climb up instead of our typical jungle gym type things. A lot of studies show that when kids have that type of an outdoor area, that creativity increases, that they don't need to be told this is a game you can play. They start to develop their own games around what's there, which increases social interaction between kids. All of those types of things are positive in terms of helping kids to learn. Natural lighting in buildings, much more important than they thought. Studies show that kids who have more natural lighting and the ability to look outside actually perform better than kids who are in buildings where you can't see the out-of-doors. It used to be thought that perhaps that would lead to daydreaming and looking out, but just the opposite seems to be true in studies. Now, they're fledgling, and they're just early because schools haven't changed that much. But in terms of, as a taxpayer, just a better design of a building saves thousands of dollars in terms of energy usage and the type of lighting that can be used. And in healthcare-related things with some of the carpeting and other items in the building, which gives off some toxic fumes, which some kids are more allergic to, and you're in a confined area.
In the media, we hear now the term green school. We know they're not painting all the schools green. Maybe you could clarify for us a little better what that means.
If you Google green on the computer, you get 30,000 different definitions of what a green school is. A lot of the green school programs deal simply with energy usage, trying to conserve, trying to make schools more energy efficient. Several schools in this area have gone to using geothermal, where that they actually sink wells in the ground. They bring that groundwater up. Groundwater stays about 55 degrees, so that in terms of cooling the building, they can use that groundwater and they can cool the building in the summer without having to chill it much. And in the winter, to heat it, you're starting at 55 degrees, so to raise it 15 degrees to a comfortable temperature for heating isn't that difficult either. But I think that several areas have recognized green schools and have come up with a more comprehensive program. I'll speak briefly to Maryland's program because I'm more familiar with that. But to become a green school, there are three basic areas that are looked at on an application that a school puts in to get recognition as a green school. One is on the curriculum and instruction area. Rather than just say you're going to be an energy efficient school, they want to look that there is some type of environmentally related instruction going on at all grade levels. Whether kids at one grade level are researching bluebird habitats and building bluebird boxes and putting a bluebird trail on the school grounds, whether they're in some classes raising shad to be released into the river, raising horseshoe crabs to be re-released, some type of activity, some instruction on local issues where you're not talking about something abstract like the rainforest, which most kids don't have a concept of, but you're talking about something that's going on in your neighborhood, as well as some type of celebration for kids around achievements. Whether they present to the PTA, whether they present to someone on how they can reduce energy consumption in their own house, then some type of celebration recognition after that. I mean, it can be cake and ice cream party, it can be something, but something where the kids see, hey, we presented information, we've gotten some feedback on that. There's also community involvement that's necessary, where that they want community partnerships, where that they want folks, whether it's parents, whether it's local agencies, whether it's industry, coming in and helping kids and kids interacting with industry so they get a sense of that. And then design of the building. How can we save energy? How can we be more efficient? Does someone monitor the recycling in the building? Those types of activities.
Can you give some examples of green school projects that have gotten students excited and involved?
Sure. They run the gamut of what your imagination can come up with. Several of the schools work with their building service folks, work with the parents, and they create a no-mow zone. where that they have all this grassy area. Some of it's on a hillside, doesn't make sense to mow it. So they work. Building service is usually happy that they don't have to mow something on the hillside. You're taking that out. If they can, they plant it with native plants, trees, to lessen runoff. They do those types of things. A lot of schools do a no-waste lunch one day a week. Well, they'll say, try to come in and let's reduce the amount of waste that we have going in the trash cans as much as possible. So they bring in things that have less packaging. They may bring in bottles that they can reuse instead of drink once and throw away. And they actually weigh that on that particular day. And they chart that trash over a year's time to see what they're putting in the waste system. A lot of schools do plantings. They do ponds. They do little wetland areas that they plant. A lot of outside help with that. It's those type of activities that kids participate in that they then have some ownership.
Do you see results when the kids go from an environment like that in elementary school or middle school to what happens when the kids reach high school?
Part of it is that it's hard to track those particular kids and see if there's any results to that. I do know that some of the schools and some of the kids I've worked with have gone to programs that focus more on ecology and biology and biodiversity, and they are now pursuing careers in that area. Is that a correlation to the experiences they had? It's hard to say. And someone would need to do a long-term type study to determine that.
Are high schools doing any programs that are eco-friendly like the elementary schools and middle schools?
I'm aware of several high schools that have that focus. One in Montgomery County, Maryland. The Poolsville High School Global Ecology Program is focused on that. They have the luxury of having their own bus. They can transport their students. Students are actually involved with community members in research, looking at a variety of topics. Very hands-on program. But that's more the exception rather than the norm in terms of high school programming.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on eco-savvy kids.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dave Honchok about helping our children learn to be eco-savvy. What are some of the recent accomplishments from some of the schools that are now considered green schools?
In addition to some of that I mentioned, several have established school gardens, native plant gardens, nectar gardens, butterfly gardens. Several have raised specific host plants for butterflies. The Baltimore checkerspot, which happens to be Maryland's state insect, is on the threatened list, mainly because the host plant for it is declining. So they put in gardens focused on that particular host plant. Schools have had PTA nights for parents where they kids, for their fundraiser, sell compact fluorescent bulbs so that they can go home and change their bulbs out to lessen the energy impact. Several have created no idle zones so that when parents are coming to pick kids up, they're not allowed to have their cars idling. They have to shut the cars off until the kids come out. Signage throughout the school buildings to indicate not only turn off the light type things, but do you know where the water goes from here, from the bathroom, from the sink? What happens to that? A lot of kids have no clue. I mean, it's gone. They don't see it. On-site composting, where it's possible. Several have worm bins in the classroom where they actually put food waste from lunch and the worms devour that. No odor. No mess.
Try this at home, however.
Yeah. They collect energy usage data. They look at graphing out long-term data. Math classes have designed bird feeders. Several schools have involved high schools in actually constructing bird feeders, which they then sell. So it's a variety of projects that really just amazing.
It sounds like eco-savvy educators could devise a curriculum where this would be a thread that would go across the whole curriculum, because you're mentioning math class. I can see English classes where there have to be essays on certain things or research on certain things, obviously biology and geology or whatever. It seems to me that it could somehow connect with all the different subjects.
I think that most curriculum has some environmental component to it, but I don't think it's been looked at comprehensively so that a student in a school system would have sort of a spiraling build upon from kindergarten up through high school. Particularly with high school, when you start getting into electives and others, I think it might become more difficult to do that. But I think also when you look at any newspaper and any headline on any given day, a lot of what these kids are going to be facing are environmentally related issues and problems. Water quality, whether you believe the science behind it or if it's chance or random, the whole idea of climate change, all of those are going to have a major impact on current students' lives, and they're going to be the decision makers.
So it sounds like parents really need to make that something they want to advocate for.
Yes, I think advocacy is a big one, and I think allowing students to advocate is important. There are times when you work with kids and you have a certain goal in mind and you want them to sort of reflect what you think is right, and they come up with a totally different focus. I think you have to let that go and let them follow through, even if there are consequences. We had on the piece of property that we have quite a few deer. So we were studying about deer and others, and we had a high school group come in that wanted to look at the deer population. Well, we were thinking they were going to just look at the deer population and make some recommendation on how to coexist with deer, which they did eventually. But they started asking questions to neighbors, and one of the neighbors actually ended up calling the superintendent, which, as an educator, you don't like to get calls from the superintendent.
Right. Oh, my.
Saying, what's going on? But it turned out that they were asking questions, and the individual thought they were looking for negative information on hunting because he was an avid hunter.
Oh.
And it wasn't that at all. They were just trying to gather information and people's opinions.
Keeping an open mind is a very important thing.
It's good for the kids.
Yeah.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who either want to know how to get a green school in their own communities or who just want to pursue further some of the other issues we've been discussing?
There are several great websites. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has a great website. They have a section on it for kids. It can take kids and families through looking at their own carbon footprint, how they're using energy, has lots of activities for kids to pursue. There is a relatively new website and a group called Children and Nature Network. It is based on an outgrowth of an author by the name of Richard Louv, who wrote Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder.
What a great title.
Yeah. He was looking at some of the same things that we're talking about, and the gist of what he came up with was all of these people that he's come into contact with over the years have had experiences as a kid in the outdoors where they've had a piece of woods or had something that was important to them. And he's looking at how do we get kids more involved in that. So that book in itself is a great read for that. Almost every state has some type of a green school program. Some states are much more advanced. California, Oregon, Washington, they have more advanced programs, but all states have suggestions on how to make a building more green and give kids the opportunity to do that.
Well, you have certainly given us an opportunity to learn an awful lot more about trying to raise eco-savvy kids. So, Dave Honchalk, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate your expertise.
You're welcome. And if I may I end with a quote? This is from a Maryland resident. She said, "I sincerely believe that for a child and for the parent seeking to guide him, it is not half so important to know as to feel. If facts are the seeds that later produce knowledge and wisdom, then the emotions and impressions of the senses are the fertile soil in which the seeds must grow. The years of early childhood are the time to prepare the soil. That's Rachel Carson.
Oh, she's terrific.
Yeah.
That's a good quote. Thank you.
Great. Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 348, and also, if you can, tell us what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.